The process was to show, look, I'm a human, and just like every other athlete, we're not always getting paid to do this. We're not getting paid to get ready for a bodybuilding show, but in order to create some type of greatness, you have to go through sacrifices. You never really know where your limits are until you're really pushing those limits. And the harder the workout was for me, the better I would feel following. So I always wanted to try to push it that much harder. I wasn't trying to gain their market share by any means. I just wanted the people to understand that, hey, this is supposed to be a healthy experience. It shouldn't be short-lived and it shouldn't be just for aesthetics. But I don't believe that the brand really needs to refresh themselves or have new ingredients that are groundbreaking, because a lot of these groundbreaking, quote unquote, ingredients are very, very short-lived. The ones that are tried and tested are the ones that stick around the longest.
Awesome. Chris, you have been competing since 1999, I believe, in natural bodybuilding competitions.
Yeah, 99, yeah.
Nice. You started your gym chains, you started Caged Muscle back in the day. You're a big biohacker and probably the most well-recognized trainer out there. So I'm super excited to have this discussion. Now, you mentioned you're in Boise a few weeks ago. We had a nice conversation with Ryan DeLuga, and the video became quite viral. And it was about the journey with bodybuilder.com. And he mentioned that you were the brains behind the first video series. So I wanted to ask you some questions about bodybuilding. How did you join bodybuilding? Then speak about Caged and somewhat about biohacking too. So why don't we start with that? I believe Caged Muscle at the beginning was a magazine I read somewhere as well.
Yeah, that's right. So I published a magazine from 2005 to 2007, I believe. I published that as a hard copy publication.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And how did you learn about bodybuilding at the day?
So I was racing motocross at a very young age in Wales. However, I wasn't so keen on buying like motocross magazines. It was all bodybuilding magazines because, you know, some of my friends were really into comic books and that was their thing. And, you know, like Marvel heroes. The bodybuilding magazines, seeing the bodybuilders in those publications, even though I had no aspirations to look like any of those people, they were like my superheroes. And, you know, it was a visual perspective, but I'd read those magazines from front to back, having no idea that I'd eventually build a career out of bodybuilding or even start competing in bodybuilding. That wasn't my goal, but I just loved the visual shock value from the people that I'd see in these magazines, because of course anyone can sketch out a character, but not many people can sketch themselves into something that resembles a comic book hero. So that was how I initially got into it from the very, very early stages. And it wasn't until after, at the end of my motocross career, that I had just back injuries that I just could not get over. And that's what got me into weight training then. And I was alleviated of the pain. I was alleviated of the depression that was associated with the pain. And that's how I really got into bodybuilding. And, you know, through healthier eating choices, I found that my brain was functioning a lot better now than eating a lot of the crap that I was consuming, you know, just to get calories in when I was racing motocross. I just felt better overall. And I'd been kind of addicted to it since. Not from a competitive aspect. A competitive aspect was to just give me a goal to work towards, because I needed something within sport to make me feel like I have a purpose. But I just liked the lifestyle that was surrounding it, you know, of having more discipline, eating at a certain time, going to bed at a certain time and working out and getting that adrenaline fix that I'd been, that was my identity for so many years, getting this adrenaline. So now I was just getting it elsewhere as opposed to on a motocross track. I was getting it within the gym.
Mm. And was that you started bodybuilding immediately after your career in motocross, or you actually did this?
No, it took me a while to find the gym, you know, because I was going through a lot of issues after, you know, of course I didn't have my adrenaline rush that I become addicted to. I had no idea I was addicted to adrenaline at the time. But because I didn't have it, I didn't know what to do. I had no purpose anymore. I didn't know where my future lay. And so I started drinking, I started taking drugs, you know, and I was just really in, I guess, a social atmosphere that I hadn't encountered before, because my teenage years weren't like other teenagers where we were partying and drinking then, because I was racing every weekend. I was somewhere. So I didn't have the normal kind of teenage years that other people did in my vicinity. So, you know, then in my early 20s, I just started partying. And I was kind of reliving my teenage years then, I guess. It was a little bit late. But I knew it just wasn't making me happy. It was very short-lived. Every Monday, I'd feel regret. But then come Friday, I'd take a couple of phone calls from friends, and I'd be doing it again. And I just knew there was something else out there for me. I didn't know what it was. I just knew that I had a purpose outside of what I was doing on a weekly basis. And after seeing so many specialists for my back, I then started doing physiotherapy, so resistance training, and that alleviated me of the issues that I was dealing with. And that's when I was like, okay, this weight training really has something to it. And that's what kind of got me hooked. It's probably about three years after motocross that I really started getting into weight training. And I gave myself then a goal a year following to compete in my first bodybuilding show, because I needed something to work towards in order to create more discipline within my actions and more structure. So I competed in my first show, one just over a year after, I believe it was. And I got second in that show. And it wasn't a drug-tested bodybuilding show, even though I was completely natural. I had no idea there was such a thing as natural shows and enhanced shows. No idea. I was definitely the smallest on stage, but I was very, very lean. I was ripped. I went zero carbs for like 9 weeks because I didn't really know any better. And from there on, I figured, okay, this is the path that I want to take. And I went to college, studied international health and sports therapy for 3 years. And then that was my ticket out of Wales. I got a job on cruise liners as a personal trainer and then as a massage therapist, because I found out the Americans tip the massage therapist better and I had those qualifications. And then it just, you know, snowballed from there. I then moved to Australia. I was a personal trainer there for a while, a mobile personal trainer. I opened my first gym a couple of years after that. Then I started contributing to magazines. I taught myself how to write and how to shoot athletes and bodybuilding shows. I bought Merriam-Webster's book, I believe it was on journalistic writing, to teach myself how to write. And I really enjoyed reaching out to more people through publications. There was really nothing in the way of the internet back then, maybe forums and some boards and such as that. And then I decided from there, I really wanted to make a career out of contributing to publications. So then I left Australia, moved to Venice, California, where the mecca of bodybuilding was situated. And then within 6 months, I got a job with WIDA Publications, WIDA International. So I was working for Flex Magazine, covering all the events there. And it was through that, being at the shows and then starting to do some freelance work, that I came across bodybuilding.com and started contributing to them around 2005.
Yeah. When you joined the team at bodybuilding.com, how many people were they? How big of a company was it?
There's less than 30 people. I know that, you know, within the warehouse and within the offices and the shop, there was less than 30 of us. It was very, very small then. You know, even though it gained a lot of ground, if you saw the size of the booths at the bodybuilding shows, you'd believe that bodybuilding.com was much, much bigger than what it was. It really started to make a stamp on the industry. And then just after that, it started becoming like the headlining sponsor of events such as the Olympia, such as the Arnold Classic, and so on and so forth. It grew very, very quick. Like, I remember in a space of like 5 years, it went from 30 people to like over 500 people. So, you know, you didn't know everyone's name all of a sudden. It was an amazing, unbelievable growth that I don't think we'll ever see in the industry again.
How did bodybuilding those days think about articles? Because I remember in the days, at the beginning, I was reading articles in bodybuilding.com. And I believe there you had a lot of articles yourself there and some other folks. But first of all, why did you start writing articles at bodybuilding? Why did you start writing the articles at bodybuilding? Why was bodybuilding pursuing this route of marketing, whereas they could do something else?
What, through content, you mean? Through articles?
Yes. Because it was
educational. Because the job at bodybuilding.com wasn't to sell anything. Far from it. We wanted to make the follower, the client, the customer, make their own unbiased decision. So if we had content pieces submitted from, let's say, supplement company owners or supplement company contributors. And if it came across as too much of a sales pitch towards their product, we'd decline the content because we never wanted to sell to the client. We just wanted to provide education and inspiration, and supplementation always came last. Always came last. That was up to the consumer. So we just wanted to put out really good content, and we wanted to put out a lot of content, which we did. You know, there's content pieces that was through articles, through videos, through podcasts. You know, we just wanted to educate the consumer and interact with the consumer, hence why we had Body Space and the forums as well. Because, you know, when you had the magazines, you'd see an athlete or before and after picture, and you'd see a supplement tub next to it, but you assumed, okay, if I take the supplements, or if I follow that program, I'm going to get the same results. Well, it's not always the case. Now we gave the consumer the opportunity to interact with the athlete or with us, you know, that was contributing the content. So the content always came first, and then the engagement and the interaction and the community to provide that accountability and transparency.
I think today the content strategy is a very obvious one, but back in that day, I don't think it was so obvious. So that's the very interesting bit of it. And having said that, I think that during the time you launched the first video trainer, which became a massive success, but again, the videos back in that day were not so obvious as today. Like, we can easily say today, oh, we're going to do a video trainer and so on, because you guys made it obvious, but back in the day, it wasn't. What gave you the inspiration of doing the videos, and what gave you the inspiration of the day-to-day thing?
Yeah, well, it wasn't me. It wasn't my idea. That was definitely Ryan's idea. I didn't want to get in front of the camera. I was used to being behind the camera. I didn't mind getting up on a bodybuilding stage because that was part of the process that you had to do. Did I enjoy being on a bodybuilding stage? No, I didn't. I like the training. You know, like I'm kind of like Branch Warren. I got into bodybuilding because I love training. Well, you get a lot of people that get into bodybuilding because they just want to be on stage or whatever. For me, I just like to be behind the scenes. I love contributing content. I liked shooting the athletes or the bodybuilding show. But because I was the only person in the office that was competing in bodybuilding, Ryan said that we needed to document my process and educate the consumer. He wanted a hallway where if you wanted to be the best bodybuilder or best athlete, best triathlete, you could basically walk into that room and ask those people questions. You know, that's what he wanted in an online space. So I was that bodybuilder that I was getting ready for a show or getting in shape. And he wanted that process documented. So I was kind of pushed in front of the camera reluctantly at the time. Now, years later, I'm so glad that Ryan did that and made me feel uncomfortable, because now I'm very, very comfortable with it. But the process was to show, look, I'm a human. And just like every other athlete, we're not always getting paid to do this. We're not getting paid to get ready for a bodybuilding show. But in order to create some type of greatness, you have to go through sacrifices. So we wanted to show those sacrifices as well. Like, I remember I got pneumonia during one of the video trainers. I think it was that first one. I got sick. I had some injuries. But you show that person how to overcome it. If you're traveling, how to be prepared with your nutrition and not use your environment as an excuse. You actually control that environment. So I think that was the initiation, you know, of that process. Like, those video trainers were beasts because you have someone filming you every single day for 12 weeks. And that's why you don't see anybody else do these video trainers, because it is a hard task. Each one of those video trainers cost a couple of $100,000 to do all in. And it's expensive. And we didn't charge the consumer back then. You know, bodybuild.com didn't charge for any of their content. There's no paywall. And I think that's what made it so attractive. And that's what kind of, you know, put everybody else to the wayside, including publications at that time.
Yeah. Chris, I was looking at the videos day by day, and I was following them myself during that time. So I know exactly how it felt from the other side. So that's super interesting. A few questions I wanted to ask there is, first of all, did you, from a business perspective, did you have to promote them in a way? Or was it that through the traffic that was on bodybuilding.com, all of the people were actually reaching out and finding the videos themselves?
Yeah, people were finding the video themselves because, you know, we were getting thousands of unique visitors every single day to the site. Just so much traffic. and not just in the US, internationally. Like, I think India was about matching the US at that time. They wouldn't convert, you know, into sales, but definitely into views. We were just getting so many views. And not everybody was purchasing the supplements, because places like India, it was very, very difficult for them to get supplements shipped into the country without it getting stopped at customs or stolen at customs or paying 100% duties. But people just watch the content for free. So that never was the idea to try to sell the video series. We just put it out there as another piece that was free for the person to follow. Now, of course, you have static articles. Yes, they're good, they're educational, but are they really going to help you with your motivation, with accountability? Not as much, especially when you don't have, I guess, a support group, or you're going to have like a community surrounding it. But the video series did. So that had a support group and a community surrounding it, as well as the accountability, because not everybody's motivated on a Saturday or a Sunday or maybe a Monday. But they had a video to watch on that Saturday and the Sunday to show that I was actually doing it and what is needed to be done, and showing the sacrifice, because we all see the success. We all see the after pictures. And we're like, God, I wish I could do that. Well, here's a step-by-step on way to do that. And as you'll notice, there are a lot of sacrifices that you have to make along the way before you even consider the success.
Yeah. Chris, I believe the first one was the hardcore trainer, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. The 12-week hardcore video trainer. That was like 2009, I believe it was. That was published. So it's probably filmed in 2008.
How did you make that choice? How did you make the choice of it being a hardcore and addressing that kind of client? Was it because of your own character, or was it because you were thinking we want to go after that specific type of
character? No. It's definitely my characteristics, you know, because I'm more of an aggressive person. So the way that I train isn't necessarily the way that I train clients. It's just part of my character. It's part of my personality. So there was a lot of aggression that went along with it. Because weight training for me is definitely therapeutic. It isn't all about aesthetics, getting a six-pack, getting the pecs, getting the girls. It's never been my goal. I just love to train, and it's therapeutic. So, you know, like I really wish they had that, you know, a lot of weight training specifics and programs for people that are trying to come back into the community after being locked up, because it's so therapeutic. And I find that aggression was just an extension of my personality in the gym. So, you know, when you're going in there, it's like you're going into the office. You know, you're not to be disturbed. You've got your blinkers on. You're not to communicate with. And, you know, I definitely wasn't going in there for selfies or anything like that. It was specifically to get work done and to be as efficient as possible within those 45 to 60 minutes and see how far you could push yourself, because you never really know where your limits are until you're really pushing those limits. And the harder the workout was for me, the better I would feel following. So I always wanted to try to push it that much harder. Now, obviously, I was a lot younger then. And, you know, the body kind of speaks to you a little bit in different ways. And I train a little bit differently now because I'm more calmer as a person. I'm a little bit more sensitive. I'm a little bit more structured. And I have different goals now.
I was following the hardcore trainer. And then you also launched the DTP trainer as well. Mm-hmm. And that one was so intense. It was unbelievable. I still remember those workouts. How did you come with the idea of DTP in the first place?
I've come across with a few of these things, such as, you know, how I fell into biohacking was through accident, and the DTP was through accident as well, because, you know, Dorian Yates is a very good friend of mine, and I've always kind of trained with his sort of style, which is the high-intensity training, you know, the heavy-duty training. And that was good. You know, I definitely got a lot of gains from it. My strength went through the roof. You know, I'd be squatting 7 plates a side. I'd be bench pressing 170-pound dumbbells, but my structure just didn't allow for that long term. So I was dealing with a lot of inflammation in my knees, in my elbows, and I've had a lot of injuries through motocross and downhill mountain biking that was kind of raising their ugly heads. So I had two choices at the time. Do I stop training altogether and take some time away from the gym, or do I try to train around these injuries? So that's when I started, okay, let me just do like 50 repetitions, for instance. I'll do that for 1 week, and I'll do, you know, a few sets of 50. Then the following week, I'd do 50 and 40, you know, repetitions, but to failure. And I'd do several sets of that, and then 50, 40, 30, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, you could kind of see the scheme here. And then what I found as I was doing this, not only was I not losing muscle, because that was my assumption, I'd probably lose some muscle for a while, I was actually creating a better shape to that muscle. There's more density there, more fullness, without a doubt. More fullness to the muscle belly. So I've generally and genetically got flat muscle bellies. So I found now I was able to get the same mental therapeutic value from my workouts, training with a different intensity with higher reps, but still going to failure. And I was getting better results from my physique and not dealing with the pain and the issues that I had dealt with before. So that's when I decided, okay, I'm going to apply this for more for my future. I'm going to apply it to some clients. And I had some other clients like Mark Dugdale, IFBB Pro, starting to follow that training program. And they had the same sort of results. That's very, very easy to overtrain with that type of volume and that type of intensity. So now, in my latter years, I cycle it. I don't do it every week. I'll do it for one week. And then I'll follow slightly lower repetitions for 1 week. And then much lower for the third week. And then I'll start DTP again. And then cycle it every 3 weeks. That team seems to work for me now. But yeah, DTP is very, very intense. It's not for the faint-hearted. You've got to ensure that everything is on point. Your sleep is good. You're grounding. You're making sure that you're in a parasympathetic state instead of a sympathetic state. So, you know, you're in a calm state. And the only time that your cortisol level should be spiked is during that workout. Otherwise, you will overtrain and get injured.
Yeah. How was the reception during bodybuilding.com? How was the reception of DTP and how could you see that? Were you correlating with the sales of supplements, for example, in bodybuilding, or was it through likes in social media and following and so on, or how would you see
it? It was mostly through feedback. So in the beginning, there was a lot of controversy around DTP because people would say, well, there's no studies that prove that this works. Now we know there are studies years later that show that high repetition does have a principle towards myofibrillar hypertrophy, not just sarcoplasmic. So now the studies are showing that high repetitions will work. It isn't so much the intensity placed on resistance, but it's the intensity of trauma throughout that workout. So of course, there was a lot of controversy around it. A lot of people were blowing it off in the beginning, but I didn't care. I just knew that it worked. So, you know, if you don't try, then you're never going to buy into it. And a lot of these people didn't try it first. And, you know, there wasn't specifically a different supplement regime that would be more beneficial for this. You know, of course, you know, if you're going very, very low volume, then things such as beta-alanine aren't really going to have as much of effect as opposed to, you know, if you're doing more high intensity and same with like carnitine, for instance, it's going to be more beneficial to more volume, I found. But mostly, it's a same blanket approach. You know, if you're creating trauma, you have to recover. And how are you going to recover if it's not through normal nutrition because our food is over-harvested today? You have to include supplementation. So it's very similar, whether you're male, female, or doing high volume or low volume.
Yeah. Chris, the very interesting thing is that during those years in bodybuilding, you went against a lot of these, it was first of all, controversial training. And then second was a lot of transparency about supplementation that was not existent in the industry then. Like, I remember like all of the supplements were proprietary blends, secrets and all of that. And by your approach, basically, you change the way that people train. And then you also change that people, the way that people supplement. So basically, the journey with bodybuilding broke so many of those barriers, which made it so successful at the end. And then how did you start thinking about supplements in the first place? Like, how did you start thinking, I want to create my own line?
I'd say I'd begun by testing other brands. So I tested, when I started doing video trainers, I knew that now I had a responsibility to ensure that I'm providing advice that is safe. Because, you know, the supplement industry, much like the CBD industry today, is like the Wild Wild West. You really don't know what you're getting and if what is written on the label is actually in the tub. So when I started testing some supplement brands, which I won't name, I was quite shocked that some of the bigger brands that we were selling on BBCom just didn't test as well as I thought they would. So that's when I thought, okay, because people were hiding behind the prop blends, there was nitrogen spiking, amino spiking, and fairy dusting of these ingredients. So that's where I decided to kind of mix a lot of my own cocktails together by purchasing raw ingredients, but I knew that that wasn't really feasible for the consumer or easy or logical. So that's when I decided, okay, I want to start up my own brand that doesn't have prop lens, that isn't fairy dusted, that has patented ingredients over anything else, and ingredients that have been tested, the third party tested and certified. And, you know, having ingredients, for instance, as an example, from fermented sources, as opposed to like bird feathers or animal fur or anything like that, where a lot of aminos are extracted. So that's where that thought process first came about. And then, of course, the people that I started Caged with were from BBCom as well, the CFO and the formulator there, Brian Rand and Michael McLean.
Chris, how did you get the idea of actually testing it? How did you test? Did you go to a lab, for example, and you took a lot of protein powders there to show them? And then how did you figure that it was from bird feathers and stuff?
Well, a lot, unless the amino acids are fermented, they are from bird feathers or animal fur or human hair. They are. You know, it has to state that it's fermented. Like, a lot of the consumers out there will never know this, but everybody who's in the supplement industry knows this, but no one's going to admit it, of course, you know, and it is a little bit more expensive. So for instance, if you want to go completely natural sweetener in a product, it's very difficult to flavor or to sweeten. But if you are going to go completely natural, you're probably looking at an extra $4 on top of that tub of pre-workout and maybe an extra $2 on top of that tub of hydration. So, you know, it is a lot more expensive as well. Now, the way that I tested it, there's a couple of people that I know in the industry. Like, I knew the CEO or the founder of Reflex Nutrition. I would just send him product and he would test it for me. You know, and that was it. And he was based in the UK. It was very easy for me to do that. And, you know, so there's a couple of companies out there who have their own manufacturing plants, and it's very easy for them to test.
Yeah. So what were the things that you found there? I would guess that a lot of protein companies would spike them with a lot of different amino acids, for example. What other things did you find?
It was like nitrogen spiking. So for instance, like when one tub would say it had like 23 grams of protein per scoop, it was really like 11 grams, you know, so quite a shocker when it comes to that. There was other things like, for instance, like if you're looking at a pre-workout, there wasn't the efficacious dosages of each ingredient in there as it was stated on the label. So it's just different things like that. However, there were some smaller brands that I was testing that tested perfect, really, really good. And I was very happy about that. So I was like, okay, I'm going to start taking those products as opposed to the bigger brands that I thought would be better.
Would you think that the companies were aware that this was happening, or they were unaware the manufacturers maybe were doing it?
No. The companies were aware, for sure, 100%. You know, because if they're testing it, they're third-party testing it themselves, they're aware.
Yeah. But Chris, then you came with fermented products to the market. Weren't you thinking that it's, if you say these things out loud and be transparent about it, wasn't it dangerous? Didn't people call you to tell you about it?
Well, no, Look, I knew that there were people talking about me and talking about the products because it was kind of shaking the tree a little bit. Because I remember we actually started with single form ingredients such as your glutamine, such as your branched chain amino acids, where I know other people in the industry thought that was a bit crazy. We should launch with flagship products like a pre-workout protein, etc. But we decided not to do that. But because we were shaking the tree and saying, hey, do you know that you could be consuming bird feathers as your amino acids, blah, blah, blah. It shook the tree a little bit, and I know there was other athletes reaching out to me that were representing other brands that I knew that I was very familiar with. And they said, hey, whoa, you're shaking the tree a little bit here, but what are we going to do? I'm just telling the truth at the end of the day. And I believe the health and fitness industry are supposed to be merged together. So if health is taken away from the fitness industry, then what are we promoting here? You know, we're promoting something that is actually filling our pockets with money, but it's not filling the consumer with their hard-earned money that they're purchasing in return for health. They're not getting it. So it just didn't make any sense to me because, of course, yeah, we all want to make money. We all need a roof over our head, but we shouldn't be stealing away from the consumer that we are engaging with and gaining their trust in order to do so. So it was a bit crazy, but, you know, I knew what my purpose was. I really value the aspect of having a platform to communicate now, which, you know, I didn't when I was a kid. I wish there was somebody that was telling me all these things as I was growing up in Wales. So I just wanted to be that person. That's all.
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, I think the whole industry changed in a way that because of the transparency that you brought into this space, it completely changed the way that companies do supplements. So that was extremely impressive. Now, getting into caged muscle, now the name changed, and I believe you also left very, very recently. But I wanted to ask you, like, how did you choose your co-founders at the beginning? Like, what was your thought process about, I'm going to choose these people, this is what I'm looking for?
Because I'd worked with Michael McLean at bodybuilding.com and Brian Rand at bodybuilding.com as well. I knew Brian was a very good formulator. He's a very good formulator. He could do things that I couldn't do. And obviously, Michael McLean, he's the finance guy, and he was the finance guy at bodybuilding.com and Liberty Media before that. So I knew when it came from a financial perspective, he would be great with the books. So I just thought that these were the two perfect people to bring in as co-founders in Caged. And then basically, you know, I knew that it cost a lot of money, but in order for us to do that, we had the right people in place on the right seats of the bus with the right purpose to drive this forward. So it just seemed like a no-brainer that these guys wanted to do it as well. So it's like, okay, then perfect, let's do this. Knowing that money was not going to be an issue, we didn't want that to get in the way, because it's easy. If you're not in the industry, it's easy to get money to get in the way. And then we're just trying to put out a product and just push all the money behind marketing to sell that product, even though it's a crappy product. We knew that we wouldn't have much money to put into marketing if we were to invest in a product. But I was going to be that marketing force. And that's what we decided as basically a threesome.
And how did you launch? Did you choose a supplement? Did you manufacture it somewhere you knew? Like, how did this work?
Yeah, like I knew there's a couple of manufacturers. So we used a manufacturer in the beginning down in San Diego. And, you know, I had familiarity with them, you know, went down, visited the premises, make sure that it was all good, hygienic. They're GMP certified. And that's how we decided. And we decided, like, let's start with, the single form ingredients first, like the citrulline. It was citrulline, it was carnitine. We had our glutamine, we had our BCAAs. Basically, all the single form ingredients that you could create your own, basically your pre-workout or your intra-workout or your hydration products in the beginning. But then within 6 months, like, we had our post-workouts, our intra-workouts, our pre-workouts, and we were exclusive to bodybuilding.com for the first year to launch that. So of course, having a phenomenal launch pad at that time and a lot of eyeballs really, really helped. And obviously people at bodybuilding.com were familiar with all of us, so that was an easy sell.
When it comes to the formulation, how did you choose the formulas for the pre-workout, the post-workout?
It was quite easy because I'd been in the industry for so many years and I'd been training since, you know, the mid-90s. So I had an idea of what I wanted in each one of these products. And obviously being at Flex Magazine for so many years and then being as the editor-in-chief at bodybuilding.com and training, I knew exactly what ingredients that would help facilitate the consumer, not only from a performance perspective, but from a health perspective. And I just wanted to be the first brand that merged the sports and health perspective together, because nothing else out there was doing that. Everything was performance-based. Nothing was health-based as efficacious as what we were to be.
Mm-hmm. And Chris, how did this start at the beginning? Like, did you have all the success you expected from the very beginning, or did you have to work in different ways to figure it out?
Yeah, I had to work in different ways. Of course, you know, I started off with personal training, then started off with a gym, you know, my own gym, and then contributing content and then being the editor-in-chief at the same time, bodybuilding and competing and doing a video series, and then wrote a book at bodybuilding.com, which is called Body by Design, which was by Simon & Schuster, which was then the second largest publisher in the world. So there's various things, you know, that I was doing. Like, I knew that I couldn't excel at one thing. I'm not smart enough to do that. But I know collectively I could put these two together where they both, or they all cross-pollinate with each other, and that helps. Like, I came out with a food company just before Cage, and that was called Nutrition by Design. I had that for a couple of years. So I was putting my fingers into a lot of fires. Some, they were getting burnt. some I wasn't. So I'd continue to contribute and cross-pollinate, you know, through content, through articles, through videos, through podcasts, anywhere that I could find that I could actually contribute and make a difference. That's what I'd move towards. But there was a lot of mistakes along the way, but I don't look back at them and think, okay, that was a mistake. They're all learning curves. I know it's cliche as it sounds to say that, but you know, I don't regret any of the decisions that I've made because I wouldn't be where I am right now.
Yeah. Here's what you say in Caged at the beginning when you launched. Did the reception was very hype from the very beginning, or was it you had to work it in different ways there?
It was a bit of both, because obviously I had to put out content to back up what I was trying to say, because I had to educate the consumer. Because if you look at all the supplements on the shelves, they all probably have a benefit, and not that consumer is really going to know the difference from one to the other. So I had to put out a lot of content to differentiate ourselves from the others without kind of being negative towards the other companies or not singling out any particular brands. I wanted to do that in the same sort of manner that we did at bodybuilding.com, is to put out the content and then make, you know, and then the customer makes their unbiased decision whether they're going to purchase or not. But the content obviously works because people were starting to then to convert and transfer, you know, use our products. And we had like the biggest loyalty out of all the brands on bodybuilding.com. People would be repeat purchasers, and not only would they put one product in their basket, they'd fill up their basket with Caged. So a lot of loyalty came very, very quick, but I think a lot of it came from familiarity with me and obviously the content that I was now putting out to differentiate it.
Yeah. I would guess there are two very big difficulties in a supplement company. One of them is what you mentioned, which is loyalty. And the other is what Ryan DeLuca mentioned the last time, that is basically you are fighting the couch every time because people might be stopping. And to add one more, maybe is probably you need to refresh the lines every year or every 2 years or every 3 years. So how did you address all these?
Well, first of all, yeah, the couch, Netflix, laziness is the hardest, is probably the primary, I'd say, God, what's the word that I'm looking for? The opposition that we're fighting against. And then obviously you have fast food or the marketing material that's out there to get you be lazy. But then you're also competing against other supplement brands, because I didn't believe what other supplement brands were putting out there. And I also didn't, hand on my heart. I wasn't trying to gain their market share by any means. I just wanted the people to understand that, hey, this is supposed to be a healthy experience. It shouldn't be short-lived, and it shouldn't be just for aesthetics. So that was a difficult part, of course. And I don't believe that the brand really needs to refresh themselves or have new ingredients that are groundbreaking, because a lot of these groundbreaking, quote-unquote, ingredients are very, very short-lived. The ones that are tried and tested are the ones that stick around the longest. And, you know, if it isn't broke, don't try to fix it. Now, in saying that, yes, you will get new ingredients that come along. You know, so for instance, there's a couple of ingredients now that have just come out in the last couple of years, like paraxanthin, which is pretty much replacing caffeine. And then you have a new form of creatine. It's like a GAA creatine that's come out now from Serbia, I believe. So you do have these ingredients every now and again, and it's very important to make sure that you do replenish these products with new groundbreaking ingredients. But a lot of people do it just because of the sake of it, much like they change their workouts every week. Well, you're really not going to know through periodization if you're actually progressing or not, because you're changing the workouts every week. You know what I mean? It should have some sort of stability year after year, but you know, it just has to have proven effectiveness. You have to make it cost efficient. So we were cutting our margins very, very fine. We wasn't making much money at Caged at all, because we just wanted to make it affordable for the consumer and give them proper products. And if we're trying to be competitive with other brands out there, then that's what we have to do. Otherwise, we'd have to dilute the ingredients.
What would you say is for the few brands that they had strong longevity and they're here for the last 20, 30 years, what would you say they're doing well and they kept themselves there?
Which brand was that?
I don't know, maybe Optimum Nutrition, I would guess.
Oh, Optimum Nutrition. Yeah, they have great marketing. And they were very, very good when they first came out. But there isn't been anything that's kind of changed since then. They had some great athletes. They had people like Steve Cook on board that created that loyalty, and they've become a huge seller. But yeah, I wouldn't say there's anything groundbreaking about their products. You know, it was in the very, very beginning, but nothing has changed over the years, really.
Yeah, they basically stopped.
And they were very affordable, very affordable. But, you know, they're owned by Glambia. You know, Glambia own Optimum, they're BSN. So, you know, they've got a lot of market share, so they can be very affordable, you know, because yeah, their buying power is huge.
Awesome. Chris, I wanted to ask you a few other things. First of all, I've seen you being in Birmingham a few times, like a few years ago, right, with bodybuilding.com. How did these events help for bodybuilding or for Caged or for basically being in person in Arnold Classic, for example? How do these things help?
Yeah, well, it's great for branding purposes. You know, you don't make money at these events at all, even if you are selling products there. Like, I'm sure you remember, BBCom never sold anything. They were just giving away products.
So many samples.
Yeah, and T-shirts and all sorts. And it cost us hundreds of thousands of dollars. But that wasn't what it's all about. It's all about, you know, having this opportunity to engage with your customer in person. And that's what it really is about. Because like bodybuild.com, or bodybuilding, I should say, is such like, it's like a very small sport. It's a niche sport. It's like a bit of a cult following. And a lot of people outside of the gym don't feel normal because their family or their friends don't treat them normal because of the lifestyle that they live. This is an opportunity for them to be in an area where they feel accepted. They feel normal. Everybody's the same. And I really love that. And that's what I love about the sport as well, is that it hasn't become mainstream. You can really engage with your favorite bodybuilder. It's very hard for you to do that with your favorite football player, for instance.
Yeah.
So I love that aspect. And I think, you know, being a part of an event, whether it be on behalf of Caged or bodybuilder.com or Gas Clothing, whoever, is very, very important to just be there for your consumer, meet with them in person and create even more loyalty. And it's just another touch point of marketing as well. It's branding. It's not something that you're generally going to get an immediate ROI on the front end. It's going to be more the back end.
Yeah, but I would say that the first few events that I've been there, they were super small, and it's more of that bodybuilding make them bigger. Like they opened the market by bringing a lot of athletes there. And my what I'm wondering about is what did you guys see anything there at the beginning, or was it from good conscience saying, we want to expand the market and we just want to be there and it's going to happen?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of all. You know, we wanted to be there, but we definitely knew that we were going to be growing very, very quickly. So we did other things as well. So we made sure that we had the live feed of these events as well on the bodybuilding.com website at the time. Couldn't make it, we had the live feed, and we didn't charge for that either. And that cost Ryan over $100,000 just to do that, but he didn't charge. And I think it was just all about creating loyalty. So Ryan always said, if I'm a customer, what would I want? I want the fastest shipping. I want the best content. I want the free content, blah, blah, blah. And that's exactly what he did. As if he was a consumer, that's what he did. It was his baby and he just wanted to have fun. And that's exactly what he did. And it grew the company unbelievably quick. You know, the guy is definitely a visionary. There's no doubt about it. You know, what he's doing now with AI, again, he's got to be before his time, and he still is before his time. But, you know, that's what he does. He sees things before other people do. So I'm sure he gave you some answers to that I couldn't even comprehend. But it was just phenomenal to be part of that journey and going to places like Germany, the UK, obviously the Arnold Classic, the Olympia, the New York Pro, all these events, and just seeing bodybuilding.com as the number one, the head sponsor. And as soon as they opened the doors at the expo, everybody would sprint towards the bodybuilding.com booth. And not only did he have bodybuilders there, he had top wrestlers or top UFC fighters. So he was cross-pollinating through the industry as well.
Yeah. Chris, another question that I always was wondering about is mindset. I've seen you are one of these people that basically seek difficulty instead of avoiding it. And you went from the big bodybuilding lifts to running marathons, doing events that nobody else would be doing. Like, why are you doing this? And where do you think that this comes from?
I don't like being told I can't do something. because, you know, I absolutely hated school. You know, people say, oh, school are the best years of your life. I remember my relatives telling me that, and I'm thinking to myself, gosh, these are the best years of my life. What's to come? Because I just didn't want to be at school. It didn't make sense to me that we are taught things that I definitely wouldn't be using in my future. So I was always told, you can't do that, you can't do that, you can't do that. And I didn't feel smart enough to be in school. And I just felt singled out, and it was very frustrating. So now as an adult, if you're telling me that I can't do something, I'm going to prove you wrong. And I not only to prove you wrong, to kind of point the finger, to show you that you can do it too. So when people tell me you can't do an Ironman, you can't do ultra marathon, you're too big, you'd have to drop size, I'm like, okay, sign me up. You think I'll suck at it? Sign me up. And not only am I getting value out of it for myself, I'm then creating value for other people if I'm documenting and putting it out there. And since then, I've had a lot of people come up to me and say, hey, I was into bodybuilding, but I gave up my earlier triathlete ambitions, but now I'm doing both. And they'd come up to me at the expos with their medal of completing an Ironman and whatever. And that was so fulfilling for me. But in the initiation, yeah, I seek uncomfortability. Like I start my morning in an ice bath because I think the more comfortable we become, the sicker and more frail we become. So if you look at like the blue zones around the world where people live to a disproportionate age, over 100 years old, in good health, a lot of them don't have the word retirement in their language, in their dialect. They don't know what it means. They continue to move. They continue to have purpose. And a lot of them are working manual jobs. And these people do not fall over at the age of 70 or 80 or 90 with a broken hip. And then 6 months later, they're dying because they have bone density from sitting and standing, from the floor, from manual labor, from movement, living on a hill that is steep. And I think that's where we fail ourselves. We try to get too comfortable and then we become frail and we die. So I think it's very, very important that you start your day with hard shit. Or do things that people are going to tell you that you can't do. Or do things that your brain is telling you not to do. If it's raining outside, lace up and go for a run. If it's cold outside, make sure that you have a cold shower when you come in or jump in the ice bath. If you start your day with hard stuff, the rest of the day is so much easier. Because of course, the things that we succeed in is usually areas that we make our biggest sacrifices in. So if you want to make a big sacrifice in the morning, then you'll probably be more successful throughout the day. And it has a transference effect. So it makes me more successful in business because maybe it's a Saturday or Sunday and I don't want to work. But because I'm trained to do difficult shit, I'm going to make sure that I get that work done on those days anyway. So I think it has much more value than just starting your day lazy or starting your day with a bowl of cereal and having that sugar spike. So you're going to have a sugar crash and then have more cravings throughout the day. It's the same thing.
Yeah. Chris, if you have a client or if you wanted to teach this mindset to someone, how would you go about it?
So it's the same with a lot of my clients. Of course, it's different per person and their individual and their lifestyle and where they are in the world. But yeah, it's usually the same sort of thing. They say, hey, give me my program. I want to follow a diet, training, whatever. I'm like, hold on, let's have a look at your sleep first. Okay, your sleep sucks. Let's get that fixed before anything, okay? And then what's your morning routine? Okay, we're going to get you up earlier now and you're going to start off with the hard stuff. Okay, so it changes, but the nutrition and the training usually comes last because that's the easy part to a certain degree. Everybody can go to the gym 5 days a week, but can you go to bed early 7 days a week? Let's see if you do that first and then we can move on up the scales. It's all about the mental change. You know, we look at physiques and transformations and we just think, wow, they got great genetics. I wish I had that. You all have that, but it starts from the neck up. So as long as we train the brain first, everything else follows.
Yeah. So you would give difficulties to them slowly at the beginning.
Yes.
And then they adapt with more difficulties, more difficulties, more difficulties before they jump into a plan, before they jump into a good nutrition plan and so on. So their 100%. Brain is wired in a way that they learn this approach.
Yeah, exactly. 100%. You know, maybe they're drinking a lot of Coke or Diet Coke. So I'll get, like, I've got a can here, Zevia. So for instance, that's sweetened with stevia, but it's giving me the carbonation. It's making me feel like I'm drinking Coca-Cola, but I'm not actually getting any of the crap in there. So that would be a small change and swap out first. And once we have that, then we're going to look at their meal frequency just to ensure that they're able to make sure that they commit themselves to eat within every 3 hours. once we've got that down, we move on to the next thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And the last topic I wanted to ask you about is, there's a lot trending now about longevity, about biohacks. I think you have been doing that for the last, at least me looking at you doing it for the last 25 years. And I wanted to ask you first, when it comes to the biohacks themselves, how does someone start thinking about biohacks? Like, do you start considering what their hormones going to look like? What's their do you have certain set principles that you set down first, and then you give equipment, or do you do it in a different way? And how did you learn?
So if my clients sign up for like a biohacking program, then they have blood work that they have to do. I get them to do a biological age test and a DNA test. And then I look at their markers and then decide what we need to apply. But a lot of it is the free stuff first. You know, make sure that you wake up in the morning, get the sunlight in your eyes, you ground yourself or earth yourself, for instance. You block the blue lights for the last couple of hours before bed, so you stay away from any cortisol spiking or anything that's going to prevent your melatonin to be released or serotonin to be released, so you can lull yourself to sleep. Things like that, you know, all the free stuff first. And then, for instance, if you're in an environment where you cannot earth yourself in the morning, or you cannot get sunlight in the morning because of the place where you live, or if it's winter or anything like that, then we'll look at biohacks from a technological standpoint. So maybe getting a red light panel that will mimic the red frequencies from the sun, or wearing earthy trainers like the Bahi trainers, for instance, that are earthing and grounding while you're walking your dog. So you don't have to stand out in a freezing cold in winter or find a grassy patch because you live on a top floor apartment. So there's certain advancements that you can replace your biohacks with. So when I'm at home, I've got all my biohacks here, but because I live in nature for the most part, I don't employ many of them. But when I'm traveling, now I'm in London, now I'm in Mumbai, now I'm in LA, then I'll travel with a lot more biohacks with me because my environment is very, very different. I'm getting penetrated by EMFs, there's fumes, there's all sorts happening. So that's when I'll apply them a lot more frequently.
Yeah. Speaking of blood biomarkers, what should one seek when it comes to longevity? Is it that you have to be staying within the boundaries? For example, your glucose needs to be in those boundaries and your testosterone needs to be in these boundaries? Or is it that you have to be sometimes at the end of the spectrum as well?
It all depends on your age. Of course, there's going to be different levels dependent on age. So for instance, your testosterone levels, your markers are going to be a little bit higher and that baseline when you're younger as opposed to when you're lower. However, it should be in an optimal range, say such as your thyroid. You know, you want to ensure that your down regulation of thyroid hormone is not increasing as you get older as well. So you need to ensure that you're within these markers. Now, that could all come down to sleep. It could be your exposure to phthalates and plastics and EMFs and microwaves and all these things. Or it could be something else that's within your diet, because the majority of the antibiotics that we consume today are not from the pharmacies, it's from the food that we eat. So maybe the sources of your food need to change because our soil is now over-harvested as well. So we have mineral deficiencies. So then we may have to supplement based on those deficiencies. So we look at those blood markers and then try to get them within optimal range in order for you to perform optimally and obviously decrease your biological age.
Yeah. Which of those devices are you excited about today?
I tell you what, the most that I am excited about that I've done a couple of times is stem cells. Because I've had so many injuries over the years from snowboarding, downhill mountain biking, motocross, whatever, a lot of these injuries do reoccur, and I tore my tricep like 68% off the bone about 2 years ago. Yeah, 68%. So that usually puts an end to a lot of people's career in weight training and bodybuilding. But I had stem cells, and it's as if I haven't had a tear there. Same in my shoulder, same in my meniscus and my ACL. You know, I stem cells are just absolutely phenomenal. But unfortunately, in this country, they're just not as efficacious as if you're going to go to somewhere like Panama or Costa Rica or Mexico. However, those places are usually run by Americans, but the laws are very, very different there, and it's a lot cheaper to get them. That's probably my best. I love other things. I could go on. Like, I love my PEMF mat. I use a lot of time on that. I have my EMF mitigator, which is called a wave guard. So there's a lot of things, but stem cells are definitely number one up there.
When it comes to stem cells, Chris, what's the therapy? Like, how long does it take? Like, you're going to do stem cells, and then how long does it take to actually for you to see the difference?
About 6 months. Oh. For you to get the full effect. Yeah, because I remember the first time that I had it done, which was in about 2017. You know, it's expensive, and I'm thinking, God, have I wasted my time flying here and having these stem cells done? Because a couple of weeks later, I don't feel any better. But as long as you stick to the discipline of not weight training for a good 10 to 12 weeks, they will proliferate and they will localize to the area of inflammation. So that's what I did for about 6 months. And after 3 months, you could start to feel it getting better and better and better. And then 6 months later, all of a sudden, you're like, oh my God, I have no pain. I'm not in discomfort. I don't have inflammation. Stem cells worked. You know, after I had the tricep tear a couple of years ago, for the first year, I was dealing with about 70% discomfort and 30% strength had come back. And then after I had the stem cells about 6 months later, now I only have 30% discomfort and I have my 70% of strength back. So completely reversed the roles. And now, touch wood, I don't have any discomfort. My strength is 100% back.
Well, unbelievable.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Chris, last question. Sure. I want to ask you, what do you think is going to be the future of biohacks?
Future of biohacks. I think we're going to go back a little bit towards our ancestral way of living. You know, that's what I hope it to be, because now our environment is very, very different. We have the EMFs, we have the Wi-Fi, we have a different food system. And I really hope the food system changes a little bit. And that's my hope. Will it happen? I don't know, because big pharma and big food have a lot of money. Who knows? But that's why I'm hoping, as the biohacking industry grows, because I speak at a lot of these events in different countries, and I just see the numbers and numbers growing. I did a tour with Ben Greenfield in India a couple of years ago, and I was really, really surprised how many people showed up to these events with educated questions. And now these events are growing, like the Health Optimization Summit in London is just growing so much by over 100% year after year. And now it's being brought to the US as well. So I'm hoping as more people invest in their longevity, they'll be able to spread the message and take us back basically to our ancestral wisdom combined with today's technology.
Incredible. Chris, best conversation ever. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.